May it please the court, my name is Rhonda Larson, Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Corrections, the appellant in this matter, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Sure.
The Washington Supreme Court's decisions in In re Flint control in this case, and under Flint, the DOC wins. Flint involves the exact claim with the exact statute, RCW 994A 737. As to the jurisdictional issue, the department recognizes that this court is probably bound by its decision in Madsen, but the DOC raised it to preserve it on appeal. There is no need to reach that issue because the DOC so clearly wins under Flint. If the court were inclined to reach the jurisdictional issue, it appears that Madsen addressed only the subject matter jurisdiction issue, so this court could distinguish Madsen on personal jurisdiction grounds if it so desired.
How does personal jurisdiction survive when DOC intervened with a general appearance, didn't raise any objection at all to lack of personal jurisdiction?
Your Honor, there is personal jurisdiction is something that can't be waived when the DOC is not a named party at the outset. The DOC was intervening essentially as an amicus because it had to respond to the claim.
What argument did the DOC not make at the hearing that it would have made if it were a named party? What prejudice is there possibly to the DOC?
The prejudice that happens when offenders file 7.8 motions is sometimes the DOC is not served. In this case, the DOC had been served with notice, but oftentimes when an offender uses a 7.8 motion to challenge the DOC's actions, the DOC doesn't get notice. So that's one of the
prejudice in this case, I guess, is what I'm asking on the personal jurisdiction argument.
The prejudice is that the department did not have the posture of the department's appeal is different from what it would have been in a personal restraint petition in which the DOC is a named party. The standard of review is different. In this case, it's a discretion. This court would review the discretion of the Superior Court for arbitrary and capricious action. In a personal restraint petition, that is the first look that the court looks at the issues that the DOC is being asked to discuss.
But in this case, once the DOC's in the soup, no matter how they got there, they had the chance to make every possible argument you just laid out, right?
That may be so, but jurisdiction is a threshold issue. Prejudice is not the threshold issue.
Personal jurisdiction can be waived, though, correct?
It is impossible for the department to defend itself unless it's responding. So how can DOC preserve an issue if it tries to defend itself? I mean, that would be really unfair to say that the DOC had to hold back and not say to the Superior Court why it was wrong, simply because to do so would be to waive a defense. I mean, that's not how...
Well, the Superior Court, you said you were there as an amicus. That can't be right.
We were there as an outside party. This is a criminal cause. So the DOC is not a party.
So you got notice, and what did you do? Did you file a brief?
As I understand it, Your Honor, yes, there was briefing, and
did anybody object to your filing a brief?
The problem is that there's an assumption that this is perfectly okay for the DOC to have this as its method of responding.
Well, you're not really answering our question, but I mean the thing. Let me just switch the topic just a little bit. Why do you care about this? You're about to tell us why you care. You're saying this is really inconvenient. It's awkward. We don't like this procedure. We would like the rule to be such that we would always get notice. And it looks to us like the best way for that to happen is for it to always be a PRP that goes to the Court of Appeals. We would prefer not to ever have to go to the trial court because the procedure is awkward.
No, it's because the Constitution requires habeas relief to be brought in the county where the offender is in jurisdiction.
That's a jurisdiction argument. But let's just say that argument doesn't fly. We can get into that in a minute. But why do you care? You know, what would be the ideal situation for you would be a rule that says clearly, or a statute that says anybody that wants to challenge a post-conviction, post-trial court something or other, I mean, whatever this kind of posture is, has to do it in the Court of Appeals. It cannot be done in the trial court.
It can be done in a habeas action. It can be done in the trial court in a habeas action.
Habeas.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so that's what you would like the rule to be.
That's right. That would
you
be much better.
To figure out a way for this court to declare, or the Supreme Court to declare, that that's how things should be done.
Absolutely.
Why don't you try to do it through the rulemaking process? What it appears to me is that you're trying to take all these very complex doctrines of personal and subject matter jurisdiction and just kind of shoehorn your case into them in such a way as to make it happen by judicial fiat. But the fact of the matter is that the trial court does have subject matter jurisdiction. And you know, your argument, we can get into that in a minute, but, you know, if it worked the way it happened, I just don't see why you don't go at it through the rulemaking process, if that's what your real concern is.
I can get to the legal argument, but part of the problem practicality-wise is that there are 39 different counties in the state, and the Department of Corrections is in a different situation than a prosecutor or a defense attorney who operate and they practice in that county. They know the judges. Everybody's inside party in that context under the criminal cause. The DOC is always the outsider. So it's trying to work the system in 39 different counties. Sometimes it gets noticed. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's given one day to respond to these habeas petitions.
It sounds like your policy argument is that usually DOC gets to drive the bus, and you're afraid that somebody else has the keys if you have to go to, God forbid, Garfield County.
Absolutely
why,
not.
Why would that be a basis for a judicial decision?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Fairness requires that one be a party. If one
which
is a party, one
a party.
Receives more
you
fairness.
You thought to become a party, and you were made one, which is why you're here. You're not here as an amicus, because if you're an amicus, you couldn't be aggrieved. We'll get back to you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Dana Nelson on behalf of the respondent, Edmund Holmes. Turning to the jurisdictional issue, Your Honors, personal jurisdiction can be waived. It must be timely asserted or it's lost. And that comes from the In re Schneider decision, which is cited in the state's brief. And here, the department filed a notice of appearance on the Attorney General filed a notice of appearance on behalf of DOC. They filed a response. They asked the court to stay consideration of the case in light of Nippling, which was before the Supreme Court. They never asserted anything about jurisdiction. When they lost on their motion, they filed a motion for reconsideration based on a completely different argument that had nothing to do with jurisdiction. So this is an argument that they're making for the first time on appeal. And again, personal jurisdiction can be waived. So the crux of the state's argument is really that Mr. Holmes should have brought this by way of a personal restraint petition in this court or by way of a writ of habeas corpus in the Superior Court. But this court has already held otherwise in State v. Madsen, where this court held that a CR 7.8 motion in the trial court is the functional equivalent of a PRP in the appellate court. And this court pointed out that the courts, the Superior Court, the Appellate Court, and the Supreme Court all have concurrent jurisdiction in habeas corpus proceedings wherein post-conviction relief is sought. And that's exactly what happened here. So the lower court did have subject matter jurisdiction. And so perhaps we lose on the other issues, the substantive matter, the Flint decision, where we've argued that there's reasons for this to for this court to affirm what the lower court did, because the Flint decision is actually in conflict with the United States Supreme Court in Johnson. But I understand this court may be bound by the decisions of the higher court.
So you lose on the merits, but you're entitled to be here.
We are entitled to be here, Your Honor. And if we lose, we shouldn't lose on the jurisdictional issue.
What do you think about the practicality and convenience of all? In other words, how did this your client started this in the trial court and recognized, I would assume, that the relief being asked for was affecting the Department of Corrections. they were going to be affected by the decision that was made. Was any notice given? How did that work?
How did that come about, Your Honor? I don't know. I know that as soon as he filed his motion that the department was involved. So by some mechanism, they were notified. I'm not sure what that mechanism was.
From your perspective, is there any practical reason to preserve this system where 39 counties, you know, it's kind of like a crazy quilt, and who knows, you know, what's going to happen when you go out in the trial court? I mean, I think the Department of Corrections feels like things are a lot more predictable and procedurally neat if you can just count on people filing a PRP in the Court of Appeals.
Well, Your Honor, I think that perhaps the mechanism for that is the trial court under the Criminal Rule 7.8, which allows it to go ahead when there is this patchwork or the grounds aren't quite clear to go ahead and transfer it to the Court of Appeals as a PRP.
Well, but why go through that detour when wouldn't it just be simpler to make defendants always start with the PRP?
Well, Your Honor,
why go through the trial court? Is there some reason why you and your clients would like to preserve that option, other than just the more courts you can bring it through, the more chances there are that you might get a break?
That's true, Your Honor, and I think in the old days there was a reason for bringing the motion under 7.8 first, because it wasn't necessarily converted to a PRP, so it didn't count as a PRP against you. And I'm not sure if everybody's caught up with the rule that now, presumptively, they are scooted ahead to the Court of Appeals. And it's only if the court finds certain things that it actually retains them. So it's in the more rare case that the trial court will actually decide these motions.
Did anybody in this case say to the trial court, Your Honor, this should really be transferred to the Court of Appeals?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
The department did not suggest.
The department did not argue that. The department was there arguing the merits of the case and asking the court to stay consideration in light of certain cases that were up before the Supreme Court. So,
in their motion for reconsideration, did the Department of Corrections make their jurisdictional argument and say to the trial court, you know, you shouldn't even be doing this?
No, Your Honor, it did not. The department argued that, was trying to make the argument that the department had acted pursuant to the old 2007, the pre-2007 statute, but the DOC appellate board had already said in its letter to Mr. Holmes that its hands were tied and that it was applying the new statute. So, interestingly, the department has abandoned that argument on appeal, but that was the subject of its motion for reconsideration.
Could I ask you just a couple questions about the Johnson case? Because you said, well, you think the Supreme Court is wrong about Johnson. And I was the author of the Madsen case, which then in Flint the Supreme Court overruled. So naturally I read it with some interest to see exactly where we went astray. And it appears to me from reading the Flint opinion that where we went astray is that we assumed or said that the punishment before the statute was optional and therefore lighter, that after the statute, what the department had to do became mandatory and therefore more onerous, and that is what invoked the ex post facto analysis. But as I understand the Supreme Court's opinion in Flint, they said, no, that's not true. And it might have been true kind of factually in the Madsen case, because there was some evidence in that case that where the Department of Corrections hearings examiner said, you know, before this statute passed, this guy would have gotten off completely. We wouldn't have incarcerated him, but now we have to. But actually, if you read the statute, which is what the Supreme Court did in Flint, they said, you know, the Department of Corrections had discretion before 2007. After 2007, the statute says shall or must, but then it says unless, and it lists some circumstances under which the department doesn't have to impose the incarceration. So basically, they said optional before, optional afterward, no change in the onerousness of the punishment, ex post facto doesn't apply. Am I right about that? Isn't that the analysis?
Your Honor, that is the analysis, but there are two things going on here. And the one thing that the Johnson court got wrong, and I agree with your...
The Flint court.
The Flint court got wrong was the triggering event. And the Johnson court didn't even go to the ex post facto argument. They held that the triggering event for probation violations is the date of the offense, because otherwise you run into all sorts of due process issues with the fact that you don't have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, the fact that, you know, it's decided by a judge, Your Honor, and not a jury, and the fact that a violation could also be the subject for a later prosecution. If it doesn't relate back to the original offense, then there are all these due process and double jeopardy concerns. So what the courts have done to avoid that is they relate back the violations to the date of the original offense, and that's how the courts can justify the punishment where perhaps it's not even a criminal offense, and where the courts can also justify a later prosecution because it originally dates back to the initial offense. And that's what
was it Justice Souter who wrote the Johnson opinion?
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Anyway, and then that's what the dissenters said in Flint. They talked about the triggering event. But
correct.
I think my question is, doesn't that all fall apart and collapse if the punishment is the same before and afterwards?
I disagree with that part of Johnson as well. I think that this
you
court...
Flint.
Flint. I keep doing that. I apologize, Your Honor.
Johnson's on your side.
Yes, I'm all gung-ho for Johnson. What this court said in Madsen was they relied on the Lindsay case, where if something is optional before and then becomes mandatory, that's disadvantageous to the person. And in this situation, not only is it now mandatory as opposed to optional, but it's shifted that in order to not impose it, the hearing examiner's discretion is much more limited. It can't just be discretion out there in the open. It has to be guided by these certain criteria that weren't there in the past. So I think this court's reliance on saying that the application would violate ex post facto was correct. So I think that the Johnson decision is wrong for two reasons in that respect. I mean, Flint.
One final question. If Flint applies and Jones applies, what's the remedy?
The remedy, Your Honor.
Is there a do-over on the violation hearing?
I think that, if Flint applies, then unfortunately there's no problem for Mr. Holmes. I think this court would have to, not follow Flint for the reasons stated in Johnson, to find that there was to affirm what the trial court did here.
Right.
So.
But if we follow Flint.
If you follow Flint, then.
Does it have to go back to the trial court for a determination of what community custody remains?
I think it should go back to the trial court because, just to answer Your Honor's question, I think that perhaps the AG can answer this. There's been some new amendments that are retroactive that affect perhaps how his confinement time might be scored against community custody.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
On that last point, I did want to point out that there is a statute that has been in existence for quite a while that states that the Department of Corrections is the only entity that is allowed to do the tolling calculations. So it shouldn't go back to the trial court. It should go back to the DOC to decide tolling calculations if there were to be a decision that overturned the Superior Court in this case. The one last point I wanted to make was that jurisdiction can be raised at any time. So we did not raise it in the trial court.
Subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time, not personal jurisdiction. Are you claiming that the Superior Court does not have subject matter jurisdiction over a motion for relief from judgment? I'm not asking about the context.
Oh, okay,
The context is it's a motion for relief from judgment. That's all the context you need.
Subject matter jurisdiction comes up in a habeas situation.
I'm not interested in habeas. I'm interested in this proceeding under Rule 7.8, a motion for relief from judgment. Are you seriously contending with all of these people watching that the Superior Court does not have subject matter jurisdiction over that dispute?
That's correct. The Constitution requires habeas relief to be brought in the county in which the
defendant. I didn't ask about habeas relief. I asked about a motion under Rule 7.8.
And that is specifically tied to the judgment, challenges to the judgment. This is not a case where the judgment was attacked.
You're talking about the relief that's requested. I'm talking about the nature of the action, which is the inquiry for subject matter jurisdiction.
That's right. The type of controversy at issue here did not involve underlying judgment.
This type of controversy is a motion for relief from judgment. I know that because I read the rule. And the subject matter jurisdiction comes from the same jurisdiction that gave the court the power to enter the judgment.
Judgment is not DOC. That's the big difference here. DOC's actions do not equate to the judgment and sentence. 7.8 is for the judgment and sentence.
You're talking again about something else entirely, which leads me to worry that you'll be back here again with a similar type of argument. Switching gears, earlier you discussed about the department potentially being denied its due process rights by the way that this worked. Do those due process rights arise from the state constitution or the federal constitution?
Your Honor, I haven't briefed that, so I would be unable to answer that at this
so
time.
Does the state have due process rights under the federal constitution?
Any party has due process rights, certainly. So due process rights exist for the Department of Corrections as a party, just as it does with anybody else.
Your office is often here in civil rights actions alleging that it can't be a defendant under a federal civil rights action because it's not a person under the 14th Amendment. And the statutes that are passed by Congress consistent with that Section 2 of the 14th Amendment can't apply to the states. And we always agree with your office. Should we rethink our position on that?
No, Your Honor, this case is not related to civil rights actions. It's a different forum, different context.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up is State versus Makovac.